Our next two speakers are both from Syracuse University. Susan Stinson is the curator of the Belfer Audio Laboratory and Archive at Syracuse University Library. And with her is Dr. Andrew B. Wagoner, who is the director of the Syracuse University School of Music. They're going to talk about audio archives and music education, development of an interactive program of teaching and study at Syracuse University.
Good afternoon. I'm excited to be able to tell you about some new directions that are happening at Syracuse University. Andy Wagoner has already been introduced to you. He's in addition to being the director of the School of Music, he also teaches some courses. He's a composer, he's a performer, for our purposes here, he's been a very strong ally and a strong advocate in the program that we're going to tell you about. A lot of you are familiar with the Belfer Audio Archive at Syracuse University Library. I've known many of you for a number of years, particularly back to 1982 when we hosted ARSC. And so you have seen the building, and you know we have rooms in the front for meetings. We have a large recording studio and control rooms. We have a large space in the back, several zones for storing the collection. You also probably are aware that going on 3 years ago, we underwent some cutbacks, budget cuts, staff cuts. It's called downsizing most places, and it's never helpful, but it always seems to prompt search for new directions and other ways to carry on in the face of these cuts. And it seems like the only thing that we can count on is change anymore. Andy has a phrase that he used that I like, which is called turning crisis into opportunity, or making lemonades out of lemon, and that sort of thing. So with these staff cuts, we went from a staff of five to a staff of one, and the first year of this was just kind of a wait and see. We were regrouping and trying to figure out what we were going to be doing. So, just a happenstance conversation on the street after lunch one day, I ran into the School of Music recording engineer, who was also teaching for the School of Music. They were looking for space, we were looking for mission, and so we have developed an educational collaboration out of this. We still have a sizable collection of sound recordings. We still had a fine facility with a recording studio, a classroom, and other things would meet the needs of classes. So this conversation led to investigating the possibilities of using our building for teaching music industry classes in particular. The School of Music has a very vital music industry program for undergraduates. They needed a really viable teaching space in a studio setup. And we were, of course, looking to bring bodies into the building. We needed to make our presence, our resource, more well-known on campus. We're well-known around the country. I get mail and phone calls all the time from you and others. And so we needed to have a way to make the campus more conscious of this material we had, the opportunities for integrating it into various curricula among the different divisions of Syracuse University. So we have initiated it. This is the third semester that we are using the control room and the small control room and the studio for teaching sound recording classes. And last spring semester, we inaugurated a course called Music and Sound Archiving for undergraduate students to start learning about what we have in the building, but to learn the history of the sound recording industry, the technical development of the phonograph, the various formats of sound recording carriers that have existed over the history of this, and to see and hear what they're all about, the contents, the performers, the various sizes and colors. You know, there's an endless array of information that we can convey. But to start with a basic course so that they can themselves experience this material, start to use it, and the ripple effect of them speaking with their peers, with other faculty, would generate more people using the archive, more people signing up for the course in the future. So we had an intrepid group of five students, and they were all very different in their things they were interested in doing. We gave them the option of doing either a paper researching type of recording, or helping me with the project in the building, because it was obvious to them that I would be pleased to have help, and there were places where they could serve in a useful capacity. Three of them chose to do papers, two of them chose to help me with projects. And it was a very interesting semester, and I learned a lot from them about what they expected to find, what they were surprised to find. I learned about what we can do with this course in the future. This was kind of the shakedown cruise, and we had a wonderful semester, and it's the groundwork for much more activity in the future. I think now I'd like to ask Andy to tell you more about the music industry curriculum and more of the plans that the school has for enhancing the collaboration between our departments.
Many of you probably know that the Chinese character for crisis is also the character for opportunity, so I can't claim to have made that up. A very good thing happened to the School of Music and to the Belfer Archive simultaneously 4 years ago, and that's that they both almost went out of business. The School of Music in particular was really on the ropes and was being caught in the night of long knives that university downsizing has come to represent. And we moaned quite a lot and appealed to the conscience of the university, and then realized that if we didn't actually get busy and rethink our curriculum and our whole reason for being, that we were going to be no longer. So part of that was passing a brand new curriculum that was school-wide, and that attempted to address some of the issues that we faced that were specific to our program. And I don't want to spend a lot of time on those, but one of them dealt with an issue that in the university has been described as centrality. There's a kind of an unholy trinity that university administrators have become very fond of when they talk about programs on campus: quality, centrality, and demand. And it's become clear to us that centrality flows from demand, and that quality is there somewhere. We've worked very hard to build a program of the highest possible quality, and in 4 years the numbers of students and level of students has come up considerably every year, while at the same time demonstrating our centrality to the university, which used to be defined in terms of contributing to the cultural health of the institution, but which today also has to be understood in terms of tuition credits and how big a piece of the pie the school is able to warrant for itself. And so the collaboration with Belfer helped us deal with several problems at once, not the least of which was providing, and the most important of which was providing a really singular experience for our students. And as Sue mentioned, it gave Belfer an opportunity to demonstrate that they also were central to the life of the campus. And so it was really a very good thing for both of us, I think. I know that we have a much better sense of who we are and what we're about these days than we did 4 or 5 years ago. The thing that has been, I think, signal in the success of this program for us is that it has challenged, and in fact it is pretty much overturned, notions about the nature of text in musical study, notions that have been paramount for, you know, the last 100 years at least, really since the modern music school was created along European models and then, you know, imported to this country back in the pre-war years. for that time, text has been understood as the printed page, page of music, which a musician studies in the hopes of realizing the intentions of the composer, whatever that means. The intentions of the composer always being somewhat ephemeral and very difficult to deduce simply from a page of manuscript. And yet there's been a kind of a slavish adherence to the printed page as the absolute arbiter of musical signification in music schools. And so we have improvisation, which is a basic facet of music the world over that has been more or less a dead art in Western music, with the exception of jazz and some other art forms. And then we also have this whole legacy of recorded sound, which music programs have been slow to recognize. And one of the best things for us has been turning students on to the fact that the entire history, recorded history of the modern musical scene, exists in the Belfer Archive. And that when we talk about performance practice, changes in performance practice from the late 19th century up through our own time, we talk about different romantic notions of performance, Baroque music, early music, jazz, blues, etc., that entire legacy exists in this tangible form in the archive, and that one needn't simply keep one's nose in a book and take on faith what one hears in a private lesson. And more of our students are becoming hip to that and are going to the archive and checking this out, doing comparative work, listening to different recordings, etc. At the same time, we haven't wanted to throw the baby out with the bathwater. We're not determined to completely overturn the whole tradition of music making and musical study. And so I drew up some sample curricula just to give you a sense of what we're doing. Junior and senior years, typically students take about 16 credits of private lessons, 3 credits of upper division theory and history courses. Counterpoint is still required of all students, basically 16th century counterpoint. 8 credits of ensemble, required courses in world music, intro to ethnomusicology, area-specific electives, academics, and then woven into that basic framework, 3 credits of studio recording, which is taught at Belfer, and takes advantage of the uniqueness of the Belfer studio. It's a hardwood studio with high ceilings, and so for classical music and jazz and other acoustic music, it provides an excellent atmosphere for the capturing of something like an authentic warm sound, a sound that doesn't have to be futzed with too much after the fact. Live sound and concert recording is a course that's based in Belfer second semester, but then sends students out into concert settings for remote recording. These are courses that hadn't been offered on campus before and were really not possible until we put this collaboration together. The focus of the Newhouse recording program, which is an excellent program, is almost exclusively on commercial music, the pop industry, recording jingles, etc., and so it's a very different kind of studio approach. Then we have the course that Sue mentioned in music and sound archiving, which, in spite of the fact that it had 5 students at its first semester, should be heavily enrolled this coming semester, given the kind of word of mouth that the course received. And then we also have just begun to think about how we can make the archive available for students who wish to do further independent studies in advanced archiving work. And there are a number of projects that we're looking toward, one of which involves having students doing transfers for inclusion in a weekly radio program from the archive. The program already exists, but we hope to expand the program, distribute it nationally, and have students be involved in that from the ground up. So that's just one of, you know, obviously hundreds of different projects with which we can involve students. So that's really, you know, in a nutshell, that's how it works. We see the integration of recorded sound and the whole history of recorded sound into the existing music curriculum as part of a central part of our mission over the next, you know, getting into the next millennium. It seems that it's about time, given that the 20th century is over, that classical musicians began to recognize, however grudgingly, that recorded sound is a form of text, and is a form of text that in some cases is every bit as important and perhaps even more reliable than the actual written musical page.
I think I can expand on a couple of things that Andy has said. He mentioned the broadcast of material for 2 years now, as of this month, we have been once a month putting up a program on Syracuse's local PBS FM station. They have a program every Monday night or Sunday night called Discography. And once a month out of those 4 Sundays in the month, it's an hour of material from the archive. And I work with a fellow named Chuck Klaus, who's the producer of this particular show and the host of it as well. And we've come up with some pretty interesting materials that have generated phone calls, donations, and just a general increased awareness right in central New York about this collection, which, again, is still a well-kept secret. In addition to the undergraduate course that we did for the School of Music, we are doing a course for University College, which is our adult education branch of SU, starting a week from tomorrow night, so I'm going to be busy when I get home this weekend. A 6-week course called Sound Ideas, and it's a non-credit humanities course, fun education, broaden your horizons kind of things for older people, retired people, or just general adult learners. And we're going to just explore the archive and get a sense of people who have never seen this stuff before, or people who have lived with it for years, and have some fun. But we're going to let them do our October broadcast. We're going to let them design the program and make the selections and see how we clean and record these materials. I might add, too, that I have a co-instructor for these courses named Robert Hodge, who is currently a video engineer at the Newhouse School, but he's a member of ours. He's a longtime collector of sound recordings. He's also into film and radio. He's known to some of you, I know, and I've worked together with him on a number of projects, and he's my right-hand person, because, as you know, with the staffing situation, I can't wear all the hats I ought to, probably, so I depend on him very much. He's very knowledgeable, and so he will be serving as co-instructor for this course. One other thing that we did in the spring, at the end of April, we had a symposium in the building, a one-day event for faculty to bring them into the archive and to have them hear from other faculty and students who had used the collection for research, and to hear from some non-university people who had also used it, Fred Williams being one of those people. Fred came up and spoke at great length about all the wonderful information he's gotten from us over the years. And we gave these people a tour of the building. We went into the studio. We recorded some of us saying the alma mater onto a wax cylinder just for some fun and demonstration of the early technologies. And these are the ways that we're starting to reach out, to educate, to tweak to get their attention, and to build up a new direction for this really phenomenal resource. And can't tell what the future holds, but we do hope that this will be the beginning of the inspiration for a number of other educational efforts in this field, which I believe is been minimal so far. Stay tuned. Anyone have any questions or comments?
The faculty who took part in that symposium have begun to make use of the archive on a more regular basis. A number of our faculty have brought their classes down to the facility, classes that ostensibly are not connected with this collaboration, music education courses, music history courses, whatever the course may be. Faculty have brought groups of students down into the archive to spend a couple of hours surveying different recordings and looking at the technology and also looking at the whole lifestyle that the technology helped to create, getting a sense of which machines were in which living rooms and from that which style of music was likely to be heard in which living room and you know, beginning to put together all of those issues, sociological issues, cultural issues, in some cases ethnic issues, and issues of musical substance. And of course, having all that, if you've been to the archive, you know that there's this wonderful collection of different types of old machines, even a graphophone. If you've seen it, you know that that allows students to begin to connect those issues in ways that they couldn't otherwise. And so the faculty have really taken to this, and I would encourage you all who work with music faculties or at least work in a place where there are music faculties to try to initiate some discussion with them to get something like that happening. Questions? Yes, in the back. I think we probably both want to jump in. First, I think that's all excellent. Nothing I can add to that. Our course and the course I teach in the history of American pop music also comes down to the archive and looks at old blues 78s, et cetera. So, and that's a course that's open to music majors and non-majors. So you're right, obviously pop music is something that has to be taken seriously.
We do have people from other disciplines in the university, the Newhouse, the radio broadcast people, the drama, Shakespeare, they're looking for other things besides music.
Yes?
It's your school.
Actually, I don't, no. When we first got into this, there was so much emphasis on the music industry major that I deliberately stopped mentioning music industry as a separate phenomenon, in part because I didn't want to see work with the archive ghettoized and seen as the province of those kids who were going to work in the industry somehow, and all the, for classical musicians anyway, all the negative pejorative stereotypes that raises. And so we've worked really hard to integrate that program into the whole school fabric. And if there's any major, though, having said all that, if there's any major that is probably positioned to make the most use of the archive, it is the music industry major. And so in that sense, there's already a major in place. Because at the upper division, the junior and senior years, music industry majors elect a certain track to follow. And for one student, it might be film scoring. For another, it might be management. For yet another, it might be archival work, just the sort of thing that we're teaching in those courses. But for the most part, we've wanted to avoid that kind of separating off of the program, and we've wanted to see it more as a pan-school phenomenon.
There's also the potential for it to be used by the School of Information Studies, which used to be called Library Science, because it deals with non-print materials, and they bring classes in for a one-shot visit once a year, probably, on the average. But this is another thing I'm looking to increase, is the interest in creating a broader opportunity for them to explore this non-print collection through the Information Studies School.
Something else comes to mind. I don't know if Sue knows this, so now is a good time to tell her. How are you? There is an initiative on campus right now to create a master's program in multimedia that will draw from programs across campus. And if it works, and it's actually academically and creatively substantive, it could be an excellent, visionary kind of program. There are a couple of programs like it already around the country. And I'm on a subcommittee that's looking at that, and I've already suggested bringing the archive, this is what you didn't know, bringing the archive into this and moving beyond the undergraduate level more into the graduate level. So to that extent, there could be at least a separate degree program.
Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Copies of our new brochure, the updated version, available up here for you if you want.